Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you might have heard we launched this little thing, a Sundial Book Club. This is a group where we share and discuss books and characters unique to South Florida. So on the first Tuesday of every month, we're going to pick a South Florida-themed book, give you the month to read it. But during that month, you can share your thoughts, ask questions, share photos of the book, all of that. Find us on Facebook. It's the Sundial Book Club on Facebook. Just ask to join. Everybody can join, and we're happy to have you. On the third week, we're going to interview the author. And, of course, that's today. And the last week of the month, we're going to have a great guest of panelists to talk about the book and other things that we're reading. And you might be one of the panelists. We're going to choose somebody from South Florida to join us on that panel. The first book we chose for this one is Make Your Home Among Strangers by Janine Gabok-Rousset. Janine was born and raised in Hialeah, and her book follows a young lady, Lizette Ramirez, a Cuban-American, who decides to leave for a prestigious college far from home. Now, this is a big step for Lizette, who's the first person in her family to go to college. And at college, she has a hard time keeping up with her studies and being away from home. And going to college is seen as betrayal, actually, by Lizette's family. Rousset chronicles Lizette's experiences and tackles the themes of identity, love, and immigration. Rousset joined us earlier this month to talk about her book, and we started off by talking and asking her about, well, describing Miami for those who really never been here.
My life growing up in Miami is pretty intensely tied to family and seeing family in and around the city. It's hard for me. I enjoyed some of the aspects of Miami living growing up, like, you know, going out to clubs and dancing and the sort of amazing and spectacular nightlife. But I didn't really appreciate what it was like to live there until I left and became terribly homesick once, you know, I saw that my life and career were taking me away from sort of my hometown. And I don't know. I remember we'd go to the beach a lot on like a Tuesday. And yeah, I live in Nebraska now, and there are some rough Tuesdays because I'm like, I just need to, you know, everything would get figured out by just going out to the beach and looking at the water or something like that. So, yeah, it's not that I didn't appreciate what I have. It's that I didn't even know what it meant to be a person from Miami, a person who lived in Miami, who had been really shaped by that city. I didn't even know what that meant until I left it. Yeah, so it helped me sort of see it as an outsider, even though I wasn't one.
So the book starts with this lovely description of Lizette's childhood home and this fascinating relationship that the family seems to have with the canal behind the house. I love this. But then we come to the present moment, and she's coming home for Thanksgiving, and mm-hmm. it's a surprise visit. She arrives about the same time as Ariel Hernandez, and he is the fictional depiction of Elian Gonzalez. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to write a story that brought Elian Gonzalez back?
I don't know that I wanted to. I think I think the book wanted it. I think what ends up happening with that element of the plot, with that thread of the novel, is that it puts Lizette's experience up at Rawlings in a pressure cooker. Otherwise, I think all the things that she learns over the course of that first year at Rawlings would take a lot longer. This makes sense with our current moment. I think students that are in college now are experiencing a lot of things sort of in a pressure cooker because of our particular political moment right now. And so the things that maybe would take 2 or 3 years, a kind of consciousness that would develop over maybe 2, 3, 4 years of school, all that's happening at an accelerated rate. And that's what that, and so for, from a fiction perspective, right, when you're building a novel and you're structuring a novel, you want things to go badly as quickly as possible so that you have enough tension to propel the book for, you know, 300 something pages. So for having them show up on the same day, that sort of all of a sudden this choice to go away for college is no longer just about the family, but now it's about her whole community. And then it's about how those places intersect. And then it becomes about the whole country. So the stakes ramp up really, really quickly for her because of this. I also thought it was just uncanny that when I was in college, I'm the same age as Lizette. And when I was in college, my first trip home for Thanksgiving was completely overshadowed by news of Elian's arrival. And I just remember thinking, this is huge. And there's going to be so many different paths that his life may or may not take. And I've always just been fascinated with that, with the idea of what if something else had happened. And so I was just interested in lingering in that time in my imagination more And so I fictionalized it so that I could indulge myself for the process of writing this book, of thinking through those things.
I was wondering about how, you know, that whole story, you know, with Elian Gonzalez played out in your life. I mean, Lizette and her mother are just in the middle of the whole thing. They're intertwined with this kid and his fate. But for you at the time, you know, you're coming back from school for vacation. I mean, what do you remember about, you know, how that shifted everybody's lives and your life?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those feelings went into the book. I remember, my family was part of some of the protests. I know there were days about like boycotting certain things, or like not like having a day where nobody went to work. It's all a little hazy. My parents were not anywhere nearly as involved in the the whole thing as the characters in the novel are. From what I remember about it, though, was feeling like it seemed like there was an opinion to have if you were in the Cuban American community in Miami. And then I would leave and see op-eds from other perspectives, and sometimes and the typical response back home would be to rage towards that. But I was also in an environment like where I was learning to sort of think critically and understand that people could have opposing views and they might have merit to them and you could still disagree. Basically, critical thinking skills that I was getting in college were making it tough for me to just, I mean, I would just sometimes out of curiosity ask my parents, like, well, maybe his father does want him to come home. And there wasn't a place for dialogue there because it was so, so personal for them. They were Elian, right? They felt this so deeply. And the literal distance that I had, like, from the city of Miami made me think, well, you get what I'm saying? Like, I don't want to say that I agreed with any of that stuff. I'm just saying that I was like, but people that think the opposite of you are just as upset. So what does that mean? And can we think about it a little bit? And that was not a popular opinion in my household.
Like Lizette, though, did you find yourself bouncing back and forth depending on where you were? If you were home, you had to take a certain stance. If you were off to college, you could see the world differently.
Yeah, I think if I found this novel as a reader, if I hadn't written it and some other writer had written it, and I would, you know, which is a weird thing to think about, and I'd read it, I would have been like, yes, that is totally how I felt. Because when I was home, I was weirdly the person who's like, well, but let's think about the other side here. And that was just like really upsetting for people. And then when I was in college, I had like a free Elian like sign, right? And I was just like completely like I remember, yeah, I don't know. I just remember people trying to talk to me about it. And I was like, you don't know what's going on. You don't get to talk about it. You're reading two pieces in the New York Times and you think you're an expert now on where I'm from. Like you're not from that community. So it was weird to ping pong between those two feelings. I mean, now there's all sorts of like that's an element of code switching in there. But it did feel strange to be dislocated. And I often felt like I wish I could just be home. That was what felt right, was just being home. But at the same time, that is a place of safety, right? Like, oh, everyone feels the same way. And so, I don't know, I felt like it was my job to sort of push that when I was home, even if that meant that like I would eat dinner in my room.
I wanted to ask you about you. You did sketch comedy.
I did for a little while.
How does one do that? How do you get into that?
I lucked into when I was in college. There was a sketch comedy group on campus, and I was way too intimidated by how funny they were to audition the first semester. But I did the second semester because it was one of those feelings of like, well, I'm never going to get to try something like this otherwise. So that's how I got started. I auditioned for a sketch comedy writing group. It was a really like bizarrely rigorous audition. I did not realize how serious they were about what they did, which is why they were so funny. Alumni from the group now write for The Daily Show, for John Oliver, Last Week Tonight. They've all gone on to have big careers in comedy. I'm the weirdos like writing like literary fiction now.
But did
and
you,
a professor.
You,
but yeah.
I'm curious as to what your parents thought when you said, hey, I'm gonna do some of this.
I'm trying to remember if I even told them. because, I mean, I think they figured it out eventually. But I think I suspected that they'd be like, okay, well, but you're in school to study. And I somehow knew, even though I was a first-gen college student, I somehow knew, I was like, right, but this is part of what I'm – this is part of the experience of growing as a person and sort of expanding what I can do and what I feel comfortable doing. This is actually possibly more important than some of the classes I'll take. And that's a hard thing to explain when your parents haven't gone to college. They're like, no, you're supposed to be in college. You're not supposed to be like touring New England with a comedy group. And you're like, no, actually, that's like the safest environment to do this kind of thing. And you want me to do it in college. You don't want me to graduate and then like do it for 3 years after college and be like totally broke. You don't want that. So, yeah, I told them about it. I know that I had told them that I was auditioning and that I was doing it. I don't think they knew how intense and rigorous and professional the group was. And that's probably for the best, because I think they would have been like, you should be studying. I mean, I did fine. I balanced it all eventually. But I think if they'd known that it was as time consuming as it could be, they might have been like, maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you just like join Spanish club.
Well, now you're a teacher.
I'm a professor. At the University of Nebraska.
How do you describe your teaching style?
Mostly zany make-em-ups, right? Like, I'm just so wackadoo. No, I'm just kidding. I have the luxury of teaching creative writing, and I say that because what it means is that most of the students that come to my class, I'm the class that they're excited about and that is going to be their fun class in their minds. And then I disavow of that very quickly. But it's still pretty fun, but it is rigorous. I would say that now that we're putting them together, a lot of my sort of pedagogical approach, my teaching style, is very much based on my time in the comedy group. I work very hard to make my students uncomfortable, because only through discomfort can there be growth. So I ask them to write about things that make them uncomfortable. I will sometimes ask them to do things in class that are physically uncomfortable. Like yesterday, I was like, I spent the first 5 minutes being like doing yoga poses. I don't know anything about yoga, but I was like, this would be something different and makes them get out of their chairs. So when they look at their schedule, like I'm the class, and you know, many students that are, you know, they'll be there the first night in my class, and I'm like, you know, talking about the class and how it's going to run, and they run away. They're like, no, this lady's not for me. And I think, honestly, like I would also describe my pedagogical approach as very Miami. And so that plays well in some, for some Nebraskans and not others, right?
What does that mean, very Miami?
I'm just who I am in the classroom, right? But a lot of the students that that I have are from this region, right? We're the land-grant institution. We serve the citizens of Nebraska. So most of my, you know, I'd say the majority of my students are Nebraskans. And for them to have a professor from Miami, you know, I'm talking loudly with my hands. At the moment, I have my hair's blue. I'm usually wearing tights with pineapples on them because they're my lucky tights, and I would like to wear them on the first day. So, you know, they kind of walk in and they're like, wow, this does not look like a professor, except that since I am a professor, that's what a professor looks like, right? So sort of from the beginning, that's what I mean by Miami. Not that everybody's walking around in pineapple tights, but I'm pretty sure I'm the only person who bought those when they came out, right? Like in this state.
I would ask this, chancletas too?
I do not wear chancletas on the first day because, you know, I got to have some standards for myself. but yeah, it was yesterday I was wearing galoshes that are like neon blue because it was so rainy. But, you know, I try to sort of help expand the idea of what a professor can be. And this, again, comes from my background as a first generation college student, in that my sense of what a professor looked like was very specific. And it was usually a older, straight, white man with gray hair or going bald, wearing a tweed jacket and, like, a sweater vest. And there were a lot of that. There was a lot of that at Cornell. There's a lot of that all over the place. There's a lot of that here. But that's a type, but it doesn't have to come back. It doesn't have to epitomize that role. And so I'm trying to be the professor that I needed to see when I was in college, who's just completely aware of a sense of self that they're proud of and that they embrace. And I'm just making more room for those students that are coming behind me.
So we started this book club focused on capturing the spirit of South Florida, that experience. And of course, you know, you're rooted here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this book really is essential to telling that story. But do you see yourself in the future as you write more, you know, focusing on really life here? Because it was really your life, and you still see it as home.
Yeah. Well, I see a lot of places as home, and it's gotten more complicated for me as I get older. And I bought a house, right? So now I'm like, well, this is like my literal home. And I'm still, it still feels weird. It still feels, when I say I got to go home, I'm sometimes not sure what I'm talking about. And I still, when it comes to travel, I don't say, oh, I have to go to Miami. I have to say, oh, I have to go home this summer, right? Or I'm going to be going home this December. I don't know. I know that the new novel I'm working on is set in Miami. I think it's where my imagination will always live, but I'm not sure of that. I also have a book of nonfiction coming out, and some of the essays are set in Miami or take up Miami as subject, but others are set on a ranch in Nebraska or from the time I lived in Los Angeles. So, yeah, I think the rest of the country can use a lot of what Miami has to offer, so I don't mind being like a little bit of salt that gets spread around. But I do feel like sometimes I got to go home and fuel my batteries. Like, I'm very solar powered, so I have to go home and get the sun.
How'd you pick the title of the book, or did you?
I did pick the title of the book. It sold under the title Magic City Relic. And I still sometimes accidentally call it that. And the publisher bought it with that. And then with like 2 weeks to cover art, which is not very much time, they were like, you know, we're struggling with this Magic City Relic title. Like, nobody knows what the Magic City is. And I was like, Miami. It's Miami's nickname, the Magic City. She's like, yeah, nobody knows that. And I was like, well, maybe nobody in New York knows that, but we got Magic City Casino. Like, this book is for Miami, and people from Miami will know that. And that's when I started to learn how publishing is different than, like, you can make that argument. And they're like, yeah, thank you so much for that argument, but you're changing the title. And so I sort of scrambled. And the story of how I got the title is actually one that's instructive for any aspiring writers out there. I started free writing, and I was listening to, I remember, I think I even turned off the lights so I couldn't see what I was writing. And I started just writing. I was listening to Big Pun's album, Yeah Baby, that album, on full blast, and was just letting my hand run across the page without stopping. So that's just what free writing is, and trying not to think. But at the minute any phrase or word came to my head, it got pinned to the paper. And sometimes what came out were other titles that I liked. And I can tell you this, I had written the phrase that's the title of a Belle and Sebastian song. I wrote A Century of Fakers. And then the next phrase was Make Your Home Among Strangers. And when I went back and read it the next day, I was like, let me put a square around anything that could be a title. And I still have this notebook, and it has all these like potential title things in it. And Make Your Home Among Strangers was just like, for me, the clear standout. And it was, I thought I had stolen it from somewhere, because I was like, well, it's right after this Belle and Sebastian line, so it must be from a Belle and Sebastian song. It is not. And that is how the power of language and rhythm and poetry, that words will just sort of follow each other and spit themselves out. And that's how the title came about, was the sort of like trying to immerse myself in, like, sonically in what the book was about. If that's other writers will know what I'm talking about. It's a really weird process. But yeah, and then there was a concern it was a little long. And when I was like, well, we could have the acronym of MyHAS, like on Twitter, then marketing people were happy and we moved on from there.
Again, talking with Janine Capot-Cruzet, her book, Make Your Home Among Strangers, the first title of the Sundial Book Club. Janine, it's an honor to have had the chance to talk to you, but also to have your book as that inaugural book for the book club. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a total pleasure.
It has been a pleasure. It was a lot of fun talking to her, and the book was a blast. Have you finished reading the book yet? Because, you know, we're almost done with the month, and we're going to have a new book for the month of October. But again, it's Make Your Home Among Strangers by Janine Capot-Cruzet. I think there are a couple of libraries that might still have a copy. Tried to go into some bookstores. I also, you know, trying to find a copy. It's sometimes hard to find. A lot of people have gotten their hands on it. Again, find us on Sundial, or I should say find our Sundial Book Club on Facebook. Again, just look up Sundial Book Club and ask to join.